Now Gaspar started to oversee our training personally. He was there every second as we leapt from post to post, and he drilled us mercilessly through the complex hand and foot movements we practiced as part of our Kung Fu regimen. I had a funny feeling that I'd seen the movements before as he taught them to us. Then I remembered Joy doing her complex dances in Balthazar's fortress. Had Gaspar taught the wizard, or vice versa? As we sat in meditation, sometimes all through the night, he stood behind us with his bamboo rod and periodically struck us on the back of the head for no reason I could discern. "Why does he keep doing that? I didn't do anything," I complained to Joshua over tea. "He's not hitting you to punish you. He's hitting you to keep you in the moment." "Well, I'm in the moment now, and at the moment, I'd like to beat the crap out of him." "You don't mean that." "Oh, what? I'm supposed to want to be the crap I beat out of him?" "Yes, Biff," Joshua said somberly. "You must be the crap." But he couldn't keep a straight face, and he started to snicker as he sipped his tea, finally spraying the hot liquid out of his nostrils and collapsing into a fit of laughter. All of the other monks, who evidently had been listening in, started giggling as well. A couple of them rolled around on the floor, holding their sides. It's very difficult to stay angry when a room full of bald guys in orange robes start giggling. Buddhism. Gaspar made us wait 2 months before taking us on the special meditation pilgrimage, so it was well into winter before we made that monumental trek. Snow fell so deep on the mountainside that we literally had to tunnel our way out to the courtyard every morning for exercise. Before we were allowed to begin, Joshua and I had to shovel all of the snow out of the courtyard, which meant that some days it was well past noon before we were able to start drilling. Other days, the wind whipped down out of the mountain so viciously that we couldn't see more than a few inches past our faces, and Gaspar would devise exercises that we could practice inside. Joshua and I were not given our blankets back, so I, for one, spent every night shivering myself to sleep. Although the high windows were shuttered and charcoal braziers were lit in the rooms that were occupied, there was never anything approaching physical comfort during the winter. To my relief, the other monks were not unaffected by the cold, and I noticed that the accepted posture for breakfast was to wrap your entire body around your steaming cup of tea, so not so much as a mote of precious heat might escape. Someone entering the dining hall, seeing us all balled up in our orange robes, might have thought he stumbled into a steaming patch of giant pumpkins. At least the others, including Joshua, seemed to find some relief from the chill during their meditations, having reached that state, I'm told, where they could, indeed, generate their own heat. I was still learning the discipline. Sometimes I considered climbing to the back of the temple, where the cave became narrow and hundreds of fuzzy bats hibernated on the ceiling in a great seething mass of fur and sinew. The smell might have been horrid, but it would have been warm. When the day finally came for us to take the pilgrimage, I was no closer to generating my own heat than I had been at the start. So I was relieved when Gaspar led five of us to a cabinet and issued yak wool leggings and boots to each of us. "Life is suffering," said Gaspar as he handed Joshua his leggings, "but it is more expedient to go through it with one's legs intact." We left just after dawn, on a crystal clear morning after a night of brutal wind that had blown much of the snow off the base of the mountain. Gaspar led five of us down the mountain to the village. Sometimes we trod in the snow up to our waists. Other times, we hopped across the tops of exposed stones, suddenly making our training on the tops of the posts seem much more practical than I'd ever thought possible. On the mountainside, a slip from one of the stones might have sent us plunging into a powder-filled ravine to suffocate under 50 feet of snow. The villagers received us with great celebration, coming out of their stone and sod houses to fill our bowls with rice and root vegetables, ringing small brass bells and blowing the yak horn in our honor before quickly retreating back to their fires and slamming their doors against the cold. It was festive, but it was brief. Gaspar led us to the home of the toothless old woman who Joshua and I had met so long ago, and we all bedded down in the straw of her small barn amid her goats and a pair of yaks. Her yaks were much smaller than the one we kept at the monastery, more the size of normal cattle. I found out later that ours was the progeny of the wild yaks that lived in the high plateaus, while hers were from stock that had been domesticated for 1,000 years. After the others had gone to sleep, I snuck into the old woman's house in search of some food. It was a small stone house with 2 rooms. The front one was dimly lit by a single window covered with a tanned and stretched animal hide that transmitted the light of the full moon as a dull yellow glow. I could only make out shapes, not actual objects, but I felt my way around the room until I laid my hand on what had to be a bag of turnips. I dug one of the knobby vegetables from the bag, brushed the dirt from its surface with my palm, then sunk in my teeth and crunched away a mouthful of crisp, earthy bliss. I had never even cared for turnips up to that time, but I had just decided that I was going to sit there until I had transferred the entire contents of that bag to my stomach, when I heard a noise in the back room. I stopped chewing and listened. Suddenly, I could see someone standing in the doorway between the 2 rooms. I drew in my breath and held it. Then I heard the old woman's voice, speaking Chinese with her peculiar accent.
To take the life of a human, or one like a human. To take the thing that is not given. To claim to have superhuman powers.
I was slow, but suddenly I realized that the old woman was reciting the rules for which a monk could be expelled from the monastery. As she came into the dim light from the window, she said,
"To have intercourse with anyone, even down to an animal."
And at that second, I realized that the toothless old woman was completely naked. A mouthful of chewed turnip rolled out of my mouth and down the front of my robe. The old woman, close now, reached out. I thought to catch the mess, but instead, she caught what was under my robe.
"Do you have superhuman powers?"
the old woman said, pulling on my manhood, which, much to my amazement, nodded an answer. I need to say here that it had been over 2 years since we had left Balthazar's fortress, and another 6 months before that since the demon had come and killed all of the girls but Joy, thus curtailing my regular supply of sexual companions. I want to go on record that I had been steadfast in adhering to the rules of the monastery, allowing only those nocturnal emissions as were expelled during dreams. Although I had gotten pretty good in directing my dreams in that direction. So all that mental discipline and meditation wasn't completely useless. So, that said, I was in a weakened state of resistance when the old woman, leathery and toothless as she might have been, compelled me by threat and intimidation to share with her what the Chinese call the forbidden monkey dance. 5 times. Imagine my chagrin when the man who would save the world found me in the morning with a twisted burl of Chinese crone flesh orally affixed to my fleshy pagoda of expandable joy. Even as I snored away in transcendent, turnip-digesting oblivion.
"Ah!"
said Joshua, turning to the wall and throwing his robe over his head.
"Ah!"
I said, roused from my slumber by the disgusted exclamation of my friend.
"Ugh!"
said the old woman, I think. Her speech was generously obstructed, if I do say so myself.
"Jeez, Biff," Joshua stuttered. "You can't. I mean, lust is... Jeez, Biff!"
"What?" I said, like I didn't know what.
"You've ruined sex for me for all time," Joshua said. "Whenever I think of it, this picture will always come up in my mind."
"So?" I said, pushing the old woman away and shooing her into the back room.
"So?"
Joshua turned around and looked me in the eye, then grinned widely enough to threaten the integrity of his ears.
"So, thanks."
I stood and bowed. "I am here only to serve," I said, grinning back.
"Gaspar sent me to look for you. He's ready to leave."
"Okay, I'd better, say goodbye," I gestured toward the back room. Joshua shuddered.
No offense, he said to the old woman, who was out of sight in the other room. I was just surprised. Want a turnip? I said, holding up one of the knobby treats. Joshua turned and started out the door. Jeez, Biff, he was saying as he left.